journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Creole minds. These are weapons of mass descent.
These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Friday, May 29th, 2009, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar.
Silence is not an option.
Amnesty International warns of a world on the brink of social upheaval. A new report on the Abu Ghraib photos depict rape and sexual abuse of Iraqis, and a survivor of the Bhopal tragedy tours the U.S. seeking justice, plus the Black Agenda report.
This is Uprising.
Good morning and welcome to Uprising. Amnesty International warns of a world on the brink of social upheaval as part of their new report, which we will be discussing in the last part of the hour today. But first, in an interview this week with a British newspaper, a former U.S. general revealed that allegations of rape and sexual abuse of Iraqi prisoners by U.S. troops are confirmed in their photographs. Former Major General Antonio Taguba was quoted in an interview with the Daily Telegraph that unreleased photos from Abu Ghraib show a female Iraqi prisoner being raped by a male soldier, as well as a male prisoner being raped by a male interpreter. There are also photographs of a female prisoner being forced to undress to reveal her breasts and other prisoners being sexually assaulted with objects, including a truncheon, a wire, and a phosphorescent tube. President Obama recently reversed a campaign position by refusing to release photographs of detainee abuse from Iraq and Afghanistan, saying they would endanger U.S. troops if exposed. The ACLU and Physicians for Human Rights filed a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit in 2004 when the first of the Abu Ghraib photos were released. It's not clear whether the photos that Taguba was referring to in his interview with The Telegraph were the same as those in question between the White House and human rights groups. Taguba led the inquiry in 2004 into the Abu Ghraib prison abuse. Incidents of rape and sexual abuse of detainees have been documented through witnesses and survivors, but it was not clear until now that photos of the abuse exist. My guest is Jonathan Hudson, the Chief Communications Officer at Physicians for Human Rights. He joins me on the phone now. Welcome to Uprising.
Thank you.
So first, Jonathan, if there are indeed photos depicting sexual abuse and rape of prisoners as suggested by this article in the Daily Telegraph, how significant is that in terms of what we already know about Abu Ghraib and the existing photographs that were released in 2004?
Well, we don't need photos to know that anal rapes occurred and were perpetrated by U.S. personnel against detainees held in Iraq, Afghanistan, Guantanamo Bay, and elsewhere throughout the world. We've already proven that using medical and scientific evidence in a report released by Physicians for Human Rights in June of 2008, and it's available online at brokenlives.info. That's brokenlives.info. Major General Antonio Taguba wrote the foreword to that report, as a matter of fact, and he said there's no doubt that torture occurred. The only question is whether those who ordered torture will be held to account. And in that report, we used medical examinations to prove that the firsthand accounts of anal rape against men who had never been charged with any crime and who are now released are true. We actually know that through physical examination. So the photos aren't needed to further prove what is already known.
But the photographs are important in some other senses, and there's a lot of controversy and discussion, debate over the effect that the photos will have. The president said that he wants to emphasize, quote, "I want to emphasize that these photos that were requested in this case are not particularly sensational." He's talking about the photographs requested by the ACLU and your organization. He says, especially when compared to the painful images that we remember remember from Abu Ghraib. Let's talk about the photographs in question where the case is concerned and whether they are the same photographs that former Major General Taguba was referring to in the interview.
Well, they may not be the same photographs. We don't know. There are 44 photographs that are the subject of this Freedom of Information Act lawsuit.
And do you agree with the president that they're not as sensational, quote-unquote, as the ones?
We won't know until we've seen the
photos. Right,
but
of course.
The ACLU and Physicians for Human Rights have been seeking the release of these 44 photos for about 6 years. The Freedom of Information Act lawsuit was filed in October 2003. A federal judge from New York in 2005 ruled that the Bush administration's blocking of the release of these photos, their refusal to disclose the photographs, was unlawful. 3 years later, in 2008, a federal appeals court unanimously affirmed that decision. President Obama pledged to usher in an era of transparency and not object to the release of the photos. He then reversed his position, he flip-flopped, and he said, we will, in fact, instruct the lawyers to object to the photos and take the appeal even further. When he had first said we won't appeal the release of the photos, he said really ultimately the decision, he acknowledged, was the court's, not the president's own decision to make, and he acknowledged he really doesn't have legal ground to stand on. He's going to lose, and he knows it. Eventually, the 44 photos will come out. Now, do they show the same events that Major General Taguba describes in the Telegraph newspaper in London? Perhaps not, but there are, you know, maybe 2,000 or so photos that have been speculated may be in existence, and that's a figure that's been bandied about in the press. The subject of this litigation is 44 particular photos. We don't know what those photos might contain. We do know that ultimately what will make our troops and our nation more safe is a program of accountability and truth-telling and justice.
Now
for
let's
those
talk
who ordered and perpetrated torture.
Jonathan, let's talk about the fact that prisoners were raped by U.S. soldiers. This is a point that I think cannot be focused on too much. This is something that obviously is not only unconscionable and considered heinous by the Iraqi people, but should be considered heinous universally. Now, obviously, this cannot be encompassed within the existing definitions of enhanced interrogation, the euphemism for torture. It's considered a crime on U.S. soil. I'm assuming it's considered a crime in Abu Ghraib.
Yeah, it's a war crime as well. Rape is a weapon of war is a war crime. I wouldn't necessarily limit it to U.S. soldiers, however, who are the alleged perpetrators, because I would say U.S. personnel. There are also civilian contractors.
Interpreters as well.
Interpreters, but also civilians that could be intelligence and medical personnel and others who were involved perhaps as perpetrators or accessories. And so it's not just soldiers that would need to be questioned. It's a broader category of U.S. personnel. But there's no doubt that rapes occurred. In Broken Laws, Broken Lives, we had firsthand accounts of anal rape at Abu Ghraib with broomsticks and a rifle. And so, you know, we had doctors do multiple-day physical examinations and psychological examinations using the internationally accepted standard for evaluating torture claims. And that standard is called the Istanbul Protocol. It was developed here at Physicians for Human Rights. And using these standards, we were able to show here's medical evidence and scientific evidence that corroborates torture claims.
My guest is Jonathan Hudson, Chief Communications Officer at Physicians for Human Rights, PHR, along with the ACLU, had filed a lawsuit in 2004, a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit to obtain the release of 44 photographs of detainee abuse from Abu Ghraib. Now, how do you respond to the justification that both the president and Major General Taguba, who has taken a principled stand, who was the person to lead the investigation into the Abu Ghraib abuse and who gave the interview to the Daily Telegraph that was published a couple of days ago, he agrees with President Obama that the photographs should not be released because they would make our troops less safe. And this is the justification that is being accepted by conservatives as well. What is your response?
I have a 16-month-old toddler who loves to play peekaboo. in his childish mind, when he covers his eyes with his hands, he thinks the world cannot see him. I can't see you, I won't look, and therefore I can't be seen. And it's the same kind of childish logic. If America refuses to look at the truth and the evidence, it means the whole world can't see the truth about us. In reality, the rest of the world knows full well what's really going on because they've heard the firsthand reports from their fathers, from their sons, their brothers, their cousins, their uncles. They know what has happened, and they don't need photographs or films to convince them of the truth of what their family members have told them and what medical evidence corroborates that anal rapes did occur. This is a fact. It's well known throughout the Middle East. The only people with their heads in the sand that don't know this to be a fact and a system-wide regime of torture is the American public. Now, as far as, you know, the government saying, you know, what information can or should be parceled out and who makes that decision, what's the limiting principle? If they're going to start blocking the release of photos, then what's next? Are they going to start then suppressing news articles?
And in terms of what would actually make our troops safer, some would argue that releasing the photographs and making sure that justice was served would be the best remedy.
Well, absolutely. If you really want the rest of the world to be less angry at us, show that America stands for truth, stands for justice, shows for accountability. Remember the photos from the first Gulf War in 1991, we saw photos of thousands of Iraqi soldiers willingly laying down their arms, coming out, filing out, hands in the air, willingly surrendering to U.S. troops, and they did so confidently knowing that when you surrender to the U.S., at least in 1991, you would get three hot meals a day. You would get a clean, dry place to sleep. You would have access to the Red Crescent. You would get proper medical care. You would be treated humanely according to the principles and the treaties of the Geneva Conventions. Now, not so much. Now, given the firsthand reports that are confirmed with scientific evidence that anal rapes have occurred, you know, many fighters will say, no thanks, I just as soon keep my arms, I'll hold up, I'll fight to the death. That puts our troops in danger. That makes our troops less safe.
Jonathan, just going back to what is known of the torture and rape that did occur, you've referred and implied that that this was done mostly to men, but what about women? In the interview that General Taguba gave to the Daily Telegraph, he said that there were photographs that showed an Iraqi female prisoner being forced to undress, another one being actually raped by a U.S. soldier. Do you know anything of that that's been corroborated by witness accounts and physical exams?
What we did in Broken Laws, Broken Lives is we spoke with 11 former detainees who were all men who had never been charged with any crime who are now released. And we don't have firsthand knowledge about sexual abuse of women. Doesn't mean it doesn't occur.
Right.
However, Major General Antonio Taguba, as you know, led the U.S. Army's investigation into detainee abuses at Abu Ghraib. And he is a leader of impeccable integrity, and he's a soldier's soldier. If he says he has seen such evidence, there's no reason not to believe him.
What about the issue of justice in terms of the people directly involved? The president has said that individuals involved have been, quote, identified and appropriate actions taken in regard to those who perpetrated many of these acts. Do you believe him?
Well, no. Is President Bush in jail? Or is he still walking around? Because in the foreword to Broken Laws, Broken Lives, Major General Antonio Taguba said, quote, this report tells the largely untold human story of what happened to the detainees in our custody when the commander-in-chief, that's the president, that's George W. Bush, and those under him authorized a systematic regime of torture. The story is not only written in words, the general wrote. He said, it's scrawled for the rest of these individuals' lives on their bodies and minds. Our national honor is stained by the indignity and inhumane treatment these men received from their captors. And again, his words, he says, the commander-in-chief and those under him authorized a systematic regime of torture. And so what you had is in Abu Ghraib, a few lower-ranking individuals were hung out to dry. and they were labeled as so-called bad apples. And that is not the reality of what Major General Antonio Taguba says actually took place. He says this goes from the White House on down. Now, we haven't had all the release of the information. We haven't had accountability of the public officials who ordered torture. And Taguba also wrote in the foreword to Broken Laws, Broken Lives on brokenlives.info. You can find the document, read it for yourself. But he says, after years of disclosures by government investigations, media accounts, and reports from human rights organizations, there's no longer any doubt as to whether the current administration has committed war crimes. The only question that remains to be answered is whether those who ordered the use of torture will be held to account. So here he became the senior most former Bush administration official to accuse his White House of war crimes. People have not yet been held to account for ordering war crimes. And a few bad apples and a few little show trials of soldiers at the lower echelons is not going to cut it. That's not the kind of justice that the world is looking for that will finally make our troops more safe and restore our national integrity as well as the rule of law.
Jonathan Hudson, I want to thank you very much for joining us. And as this case that your group and the ACLU has filed continues with its appeals process, we will certainly continue to follow it and hopefully have you back on. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Jonathan Hudson is the Chief Communications Officer at Physicians for Human Rights. And the report that he was referring to is called Broken Laws, Broken Lives, Medical Evidence of Torture by the U.S. And the preface to that report was written by Major General Antonio Taguba. A former Major General, I should say. He also gave an interview to the Daily Telegraph a couple of days ago. That interview and the report based on it was published, and we will link to that interview and that report from our website later today at kpfk.org/uprising. We did try to get Major General Taguba on Uprising, but he is not doing any more interviews. This is Uprising, and after this week's Black Agenda report, we will be joined in studio by a survivor of the Bhopal tragedy. And we'll find out why she is still seeking justice for what happened to her and her community. We'll also hear today's subversive historian after that. And finally, we'll take a look at Amnesty International's annual report that was just released, warning of a world on the verge of mass riots. Stay tuned. Glenn Ford is a writer and radio commentator and the executive editor of the Black Agenda Report. This week's commentary is about Obama's Memorial Day decision.
Most of what presidents do is about wielding power, but a great deal of being president is symbolic. Barack Obama is as attuned to symbolism as any of his predecessors, maybe more. When President Obama delivered a wreath to the Confederate Memorial at Arlington National Cemetery on Memorial Day, he knew he was playing a very cynical game of incompatible symbols. One cannot pay sincere tribute to the memory of the black soldiers that fought for the Union in the Civil War while giving equal honors, or any honors at all, to the soldiers for the Confederacy. But Obama tried to do both. Obama thinks he can finesse anything, which is an indication that he truly respects nothing. He cannot possibly harbor genuine respect for black Union veterans if he conveys the same honors in the form of a wreath on Confederates. Obama is also disrespecting those of us who possess an awareness of history. The Confederate Memorial was paid for by the Daughters of the Confederacy and presented as a gift to the federal government in 1914. Woodrow Wilson was president, the most demonstrably racist resident of the White House of the 20th century. The Jim Crowing of the South was by then all but complete. Wilson was a Democrat, or rather, a Dixiecrat, born in Virginia, and he lost no time imposing segregation on the federal bureaucracy in Washington, D.C., where it had not previously existed. Wilson put up walls and partitions to keep black and white office workers apart and instituted separate bathrooms. When D.W. Griffith screened his white supremacist epic, Birth of a Nation, a celebration of the Ku Klux Klan, at the White House, President Wilson gave the film its best review. "It's like writing history with lightning," said Wilson. "And my only regret," he continued, "is that it is all terribly true." In short, President Wilson was a low-down, Ku Klux Klan-loving racist dog. It was, therefore, totally in character for Wilson to become the first president to lay a wreath at the Confederate Memorial. The practice began as a political act, celebrating the new consensus among whites, North and South, that the race problem, the Negro problem, would no longer divide them. Instead, the South and Woodrow Wilson's Washington, D.C., would be allowed to divide black people from whites at every level of society and to lynch those that objected. That's the spirit behind Woodrow Wilson's embrace of the Confederate Memorial. He was also embracing a national reconciliation with the Confederate cause at black people's expense. Barack Obama now continues the symbolic practice, which celebrates the definitive triumph of white supremacy over all vestiges of black reconstruction at the highest level of the U.S. government. African Americans are supposed to accept that the first black president sends a wreath to honor Confederates, because he also sent a wreath to the Black Unionists Memorial. Obama doesn't think we'll notice that that puts black Civil War dead on an equal basis with the people who were trying to put them back into slavery. He pretends not to recognize that that's an insult to every decent American. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
Visit www.blackagendareport.com for more information. You're listening to Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Survivors of the December 3, 1984 catastrophic gas leak in Bhopal, India, are currently touring the United States in search of justice and accountability. As the worst industrial accident in history, 8,000 people were killed instantly that fateful day when methyl isocyanide spewed from a pesticide manufacturing plant operated by the U.S.-based Union Carbide Corporation. Due to still present contamination in surrounding areas and groundwater supply, tens of thousands of residents continue to suffer ill health effects as a result of the Bhopal disaster, including those who were born after the incident took place. Ahead of the 25th anniversary of the tragedy, a delegation of survivors has toured 12 major U.S. cities to raise awareness, and Los Angeles is their last leg. Earlier this month, three Bhopal residents met with members of Congress at the start of their tour to call for a hearing on the accident. They specifically urged lawmakers to apply pressure to Dow Chemicals, which bought out Union Carbide in 1999. Seeking to hold the corporation accountable for the disaster, the touring survivors are demanding that Dow clean the contaminated areas, provide significant economic assistance to affected residents, and stand trial before a court in Bhopal as the owners of Union Carbide. Now joining me in studio are Sarita Malviya. She's a second-generation survivor of the Bhopal disaster. Welcome, Sarita.
Hello.
Also with us is Rachna Dhingra. She is a coordinator of the International Campaign for Justice in Bhopal. Welcome, Rachna.
Thank you for having us.
Rachna, let me start with you. For listeners who may not be as familiar with what happened in Bhopal, describe the aftermath of this tragedy. I mentioned 8,000 people were instantly killed, but they were just the first victims.
Yes, this was a release of 40 tons of MIC from a Union Carbide pesticide plant in Bhopal, India. People who lived right across the factory had no idea that this plant was making such toxic substances. On the night of the disaster, they felt a burning sensation into their eyes and massive coughing, and then they started to run. And more the people ran, more the gases they inhaled, and faster they died. Within 72 hours, 8,000 to 10,000 people had died because of being exposed. Hospitals were filled by hundreds and thousands of people, and the people in hospitals had no idea how to treat these people, and Union Carbide Corporation refusing to release the antidote that was causing so many people to die. And Union Carbide to this day continues to hide the toxicology of MIC, not releasing it, all the gases that were released on the night. Till today, more than 25,000 people have died due to gas exposure-related illnesses. More than 100,000 people continue to be chronically sick. More than 572,000 people exposed. And more than 30,000 people who continue to drink contaminated water because Union Carbide left all the toxic waste behind during its operation. And every day, these people are drinking water that's laced with heavy metals, pesticides, organochlorines.
The Union Carbide has a website that they call the Bhopal Information Center at bhopal.com, where this is what they say. They call what happened in Bhopal a terrible tragedy, and they say that Union Carbide Corporation worked diligently to provide immediate and continuing aid to the victims and set up a process to resolve their claims. All the claims arising out of the release were settled 19 years ago at the explicit direction of and with the approval of the Supreme Court of India. Your response to that?
Union Carbide gave a settlement of $470 million. This settlement was never done in consultation with the survivors, and this was distributed among more than 500,000 people. It comes out to $533 for lifelong injuries and $1,000 for deaths. And Dow Chemical's PR person has said $500 is pretty good for an Indian because it goes pretty far over there. Union Carbide, from the beginning, this was not a disaster that happened in one night. This was a disaster in making. And from its operation in 72, they did everything to cut costs. And after the disaster, they did everything to minimize the disaster. There were six things that were not working on the night of the disaster. They had routinely shut off the refrigeration system to save $30 a day. And that reflects the mentality of what people in India were worth to a multinational corporation. The settlement only cost Union Carbide 43 cents per share.
I want to turn to Sarita. You're a second-generation survivor of the Bhopal disaster. First, tell us what happened to your parents on the night and after December 3rd, 1984, and what have the effects been on yourself? And I should mention that Rachna will interpret.
जानना चाहते हैं कि गैस की वजह से आपके परिवार में क्या समस्या हुई और नहीं तो अभी क्या समस्या है परिवार में और आपको इसकी वजह से क्या समस्या है
मेरे मम्मी पापा गैस से अफेक्टेड नहीं है पर हम आज से 8-10 साल पहले उन बस्तियों में आए हैं जिन बस्तियों का पानी यूनियन कार्बाइड की वजह से जहरीला उसकी वजह से मेरे परिवार में असर हुआ है मेरे पापा की आंखों में जलन होती है मेरी मम्मी की भी सांस फूलती है वो भारी काम नहीं कर सकती मैं भी अपना स्कूल बैग ले जाती हूँ तो मेरी सांस फूलती है बोर्ड पे ध्यान से देखती हूँ तो आंखों से आंसू आते हैं और मेरे हाथ की खाल हमेशा सूखी सूखी रहती है और इनमें से पानी आता है और खाल निकलती है
My parents were not affected by gas. We moved into Bhopal, city of Bhopal, much later. But we moved into one of the 16 communities where water continues to be contaminated. And we had no idea that the water was contaminated here. After moving, we moved into this community with my, I moved into this community with my family 10 years ago. My father suffers from breathlessness. My mother has started developing problems with her eyes and is unable to do any heavy physical work. If I carry my school bag for a long time, I feel breathless. And I have developed this strange problem with my skin where I constantly lose skin in my hands every 3 to 4 weeks and they sweat all the time and are constantly cold.
Rachna, what about this meeting that you had with Congress members here in the United States? Clearly, Dow Chemicals, the parent corporation of Union Carbide, has not done its job or any sort of due process. What have you asked specifically from Congress, and what did they respond?
Yeah. As you said, this is the world's worst industrial disaster. 25,000 people dead, and both corporations continue to do business as usual and make profits as usual. So we wanted to come to United States and talk to the people in the government here and ask them to take charge. This disaster cannot continue any longer. So we have met several people in the Congress, and actually Frank Pallone, who has been very supportive, he has circulated a Dear Colleague letter in the Congress which is addressed to Dow Chemical's board of directors and CEO, asking them to clean up. And at this point, we are asking all different, reaching out to different congressmen and asking them to sign on to this letter, which will eventually go out to Dow. A second big thing we are asking, we are wanting, is a congressional hearing on the issue of Bhopal gas disaster. And we want Congressman Henry Waxman to initiate this, because he has had a long history on working on environmental issues, and he also did a Bhopal hearing in 84. So that is what we are asking, because we want Dow Chemical and the survivors to be on the same table in front of U.S. government and ask, and we want to ask them some tough questions, that why, when they paid, when they took over Union Carbide, they set aside $2.2 billion to take care of Union Carbide's asbestos liability in Texas. But why will they have this double standard with people in Bhopal? We want to ask them why to this day they won't tell us what was in the chemicals that were released on that night, and why will they not clean up?
I want to turn back, Rachna, to Sarita. From where you sit, you are young, you're 16 years old, you live in India, around the area where the Union Carbide plant is, and what do you think of this huge corporation that makes a lot of money and refuses to help?
आप 16 साल के और उसी बस्ती में रहते हो जहां पर पानी जहरीला है, आप उसके बारे में क्या सोचते हो जो ये इतनी बड़ी कंपनी है और वो मुनाफा कमाती है पर सफाई करने से या अपना जिम्मेदारी लेने से मना करती है?
मुझे इसके बारे में पहले नहीं पता था, पर जब मुझे कंपनी के बारे में पता लगा तभी मैं इसमें जुड़ी, क्योंकि मुझे पता लगा कि कंपनी हमारे साथ हर तरह से दोहरा व्यवहार अपना रही है और सिर्फ अपना मुनाफा देख रही है। इस तरह से मैं नहीं चाहती कि और भी दूसरा भोपाल बने, ताकि और दूसरे लोग इस तरह से भुगते, इसीलिए मैं इसमें जुड़ी और मैं चाहती हूँ कि ऐसी कंपनियों को सजा दी जानी चाहिए, ताकि आगे से कोई भी कंपनी ऐसा ना करे और मुनाफा ना देखे बल्कि इंसानी जिंदगियां देखे, क्योंकि किसी कंपनी को ये अधिकार नहीं दिया गया है कि वो हमसे हमारी जिंदगियां छीने, हमारा बचपन खराब करे, हमारे मिट्टी पानी में जहर घोले और ऊपर से जिम्मेदारियों से भी भागे।
When I first got involved, I had no idea about the double standard that these multi-corporations employ. They have always, in Bhopal, they have always made sure that profit comes before human lives and health. And that is why I have decided to be involved, because I do not want any more people in this world to suffer how people in Bhopal are continuing to suffer. And we are very determined about that there are no more Bhopals. And that's why we are so focused that we should get justice, because we, if we are able to get justice, there will be a precedent that companies won't be able to put profit before human health and human life. We will set a precedent that companies cannot come, kill and pollute and leave without any kind of legal liability. And companies have no right to destroy our childhood and contaminate our water and our land like they have done so in Bhopal.
What is the community like where you live? Do other children suffer the same sorts of problems that you suffer, and you know, what are the stories that you're going to take back to them about Americans and our awareness of this tragedy?
जिस बस्ती में आप रहते हो वहाँ पे क्या बच्चों में समस्याएं हैं, लोगों में समस्याएं हैं तो बताएं, और अब जहाँ आपने जो देखा है उसके बारे में क्या बताएंगे, वहाँ जाकर यहाँ का जो प्रदूषण वो सब देखा है बता सकते हैं?
तो हमारे यहाँ पर अभी भी लोगों में अलग अलग तरह की समस्याएं हैं, लोगों की सांस फूलती है, उन्हें गुर्दे की समस्या है, पेट में तकलीफ, आंखों में जलन, टीवी कैंसर आम बीमारी की तरह हो रहा है, माँ के दूध में पारा पाया जा रहा है, और जो बच्चे आने वाली पीढ़ी है उनमें अलग अलग तरह की विकलांगता आ रही है, उनकी उंगलियां जुड़ी हुई है, होंठ कटा हुआ है, तालू नहीं है, आंख बाहर निकली हुई है, सर्व पॉलिसी के बच्चे हैं, हाथ पैर मुड़े हुए हैं, खुद अपना काम नहीं कर सकते हैं, तो मतलब इस तरह की विकलांगता अभी भी भोपाल के अंदर है। और यहाँ पर हम आए हैं तो यहाँ पर भी हमने काफी जगहों पर गए और बहुत सी जगहों पर देखा, हमने वेस्ट वर्जीनिया में यूनियन कार्बाइड का कारखाना देखा, वहां पर सोटर एमआईसी गैस रखी जा रही है, ह्यूस्टन गए वहां पर भी हमने ऐसी बहुत सी कंपनियां देखी, और कौन सी जगह जहां हम गए थे,
रिचमंड
रिचमंड रिचमंड में भी हमने ये सब कुछ देखा, वहाँ लोगों से बात की, लोग इसके खिलाफ लड़ तो रहे हैं पर अभी तक इंसाफ नहीं हो रहा है। मगर ये सब कुछ जाके मैं भोपाल बताऊंगी लोगों को कि ये सिर्फ हमारे भोपाल की लड़ाई नहीं, पूरी दुनिया की लड़ाई है, इसमें हम सभी को मिलकर लड़ना है। और भोपाल के लोग तो लड़ ही रहे पर हम चाहते हैं कि सभी लोग इसमें सपोर्ट करें ताकि ऐसी कंपनियों के खिलाफ लड़ा जा सके और उनको सजा दिलवाई जा सके।
In my community, there are several people suffering from all sorts of problems with their breathlessness, with problems in their kidneys, problems with their skin, problems in their stomach, high rates of TB and cancer. There are so many children in my community that suffer from all sorts of birth defects, such as fused fingers, cleft lip, missing palate, deformed eyes, twisted limbs, children who cannot walk on their own, children who cannot talk on their own. But since we have visited this country, I have seen the similar disasters and similar slow-bobs are happening here. We visited a place called Institute in West Virginia where Union Carbide used to operate the sister plant, which is now being operated by Bayer. There, they're storing 100 tons of MIC. A 40-ton had leaked in Bhopal, and still the company hasn't learned any lesson. In Houston, we saw so many petroleum refineries polluting the land and water and air of poor people. Same with Richmond in California. And when I go back, I will tell people and my friends in Bhopal that this story is not just about Bhopal. This is about all communities who are fighting against this global greed of corporations, and that as citizens of the world, we have to fight together.
Rachna, finally, what specifically can Americans do to express their solidarity with Bhopal residents? I mean, you're right, and Sarita's right, that it's happening all around the world and this country itself, and so there are certainly many similarities. But the tragedy in India is of a different scale, and Indians don't have as much power, no power, over corporations that serve here as much as Americans do.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's why we have come here, to see that kind of support and to build that kind of solidarity. So a few concrete things that people can do. One is to, if you are a university student, then please make sure that your university does not take money from Dow. Another thing is passing a city council resolution in your city. Berkeley just did this last week, where they said they will not take money from Dow unless and until they clean up Bhopal. That sends a very, very strong message. Third thing is boycotting the Dow's products. I know it's very hard because they do not make any consumer products, but PVC, polyvinyl chloride, is made by them. They make the most amount of profit from them. So they make profit out of poison. That has to be stopped. Another very concrete thing that people can do is reach out to their congressperson and ask them and urge them to please sign on to this letter that's been circulated by Frank Pallone, because the deadline on that is on June 12th. And the last thing is the 25th anniversary is on 3rd December 2009, some kind of a solidarity action in people of Bhopal would be a tremendous effort for people that are living in this country.
Well, Rachna, I want to thank you very much for joining us. We'll also try to put information on our website about where people can find that letter at kpfk.org/uprising. Is there a website you'd like to recommend to?
Yeah, our website is www.bhopal.net. Another one is www.studentsforbhopal.org.
That's Bhopal.net, not to be confused with Bhopal.com, which is the site run by Union Carbide, and studentsforbhopal.org. Rachna Dhingra is the coordinator of the International Campaign for Justice in Bhopal, and Sarita Malviya, she is a second-generation survivor of the Bhopal disaster. She's only 16 years old. Sarita and Rachna, thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Uprising. After today's subversive historian, we'll take a look at Amnesty International's latest report, warning of a world on the verge of global unrest. Stay tuned.
A community dialogue on the impact of the current economic crisis on no and low-income women will take place Saturday, May 30th, 10:30 a.m. to 3 p.m. at the Southern California Library, 6120 South Vermont Avenue, Los Angeles, 90044. It's a coming together of those of us impacted by the economic crisis to tell our stories, put forward demands, and make action proposals. Legal aid, representatives of social service agencies, elected officials, and other professionals and advocates will be invited to listen and share information on available resources, including those in President Obama's stimulus package. It's a speak out with music, lunch, child care, and it's wheelchair accessible. Everyone welcome. That's a community dialogue on women and the economy on Saturday, May 30th at 10:30 a.m. at the Southern California Library. More details are available by calling 323-276-9833. That's 323-276-9833. Or by logging on to kpfk.org.
This is Gabriel San Roman, your subversive historian. Back in the day on May 29, 1969, a protest demonstration in Córdoba, Argentina, turned into an all-out urban revolt. Known to history as the Cordobazo, the broad-based uprising exactly 40 years ago was galvanized by the dictatorship of General Juan Carlos Onganía, with organized labor and university students being principal targets of Onganía's self-proclaimed Argentine Revolution. The two forged a common unity against it. Under the leadership of unionists like Agustín Tosco, workers abandoned their factories as students and common citizens joined them in a march to the city center. After the first confrontation with police left one worker dead, public outrage boiled over into a spontaneous revolt that controlled much of the west side of the city. Rooftop snipers repelled initial incursions by the army, but tanks rolled in the very next day, crushing the insurrection. The Cordobazo, however, shook the very foundations of the Onganía dictatorship as the general resigned a year later. For Uprising, this is your truth professor saying it's no mystery why they conceal our people's history.
You're listening to Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. If you're moved by our last story of the Bhopal survivors, they're going to be at UCLA tomorrow at 12 noon to 2 p.m. speaking about the situation there and what you can do. It's happening at UCLA on Saturday at the Engineering 4 building at room 52-124. Again, that's tomorrow, Saturday from 12 to 2, the Justice for Bhopal event with my two guests and others at the Engineering 4 building, room number 52-124. And if you missed that, we'll put it on kpfk.org/uprising after 10 a.m. today. Amnesty International released its annual report yesterday warning that the world is on the verge of global unrest, with existing poverty severely worsened by the international economic crisis. In every major geographic area, the report details conditions relating to social and economic insecurity, poverty and deprivation, and more. The social and economic inequalities in regions like Latin America show continued deprivation of food, shelter, healthcare, and employment opportunities. Countries in which governments have little power are dominated by corrupt and abusive police forces, as well as subject to gang violence. In Europe and Central Asia, there is fear that dwindling economies will bring about increased discrimination and a rise in hate crimes. The economic downturn and unemployment rates of affluent countries have also added to the global despair and anxiety and point to an uncertain future of turmoil and riots. In fact, recent demonstrations in cities across the world have been increasingly turning violent. According to Amnesty International Secretary General Irene Khan, the world is sitting on a social, political, and economic time bomb. Amnesty recommends that governments take a stronger, proactive approach in intervening to save human lives from the economic crisis. My guest is Kurt Goring. He is the Senior Deputy Executive Director of Amnesty International. Welcome to Uprising, Kurt.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
So it's a very, very disturbing report that Amnesty just released. And I want to first ask you about the existing conditions. It seems to me from taking a look at the report that the economic crisis has only deepened existing problems of poverty and deprivation. Is that correct?
Yes, that's absolutely correct. It's deepened some of the abuses that were already in existence. It's the crisis has distracted attention from others, and it's still created new ones. So, you know, on all those fronts, we have an exacerbation of what had already been severe human rights concerns in many, many countries around the world. This report covers 157 countries, and you know, having followed developments in these countries, you know, one of the things that we found is that the economic downturn worldwide has, as you said, aggravated the abuses.
What about where things are worst? Are there particular regions, Asia or Africa, where there are larger numbers of developing nations, poor countries? Is that where you see the sort of not only the worst deprivation, but also the greatest social unrest?
Well, it certainly includes those countries, but it's not only there. For example, this year there are expected to be tens of millions of more people who are unemployed and facing increased economic hardship. That leads to discontent, and discontent often leads to protest. And this is happening and has happened over the last year in almost all on all continents. In Zimbabwe, for example, we've seen the response of the government to the increasing to the use of food as a political weapon, essentially. In Nigeria, we saw hundreds of thousands of persons evicted from their homes. In Cambodia as well, over the last 5 or 6 years, although it's exacerbated in this most recent year, close to 2 million people have been evicted. We've seen in Cameroon demonstrations in response to rising food prices or fuel prices, people demonstrating and shot dead by security forces, almost 100 of them last February. Similar events, although smaller in number in terms of the victims, happened in Tunisia, in Mali, in Burkina Faso. So it's not a... the clampdown in response to the economic downturn and is not a feature of only one particular region. It seems to be a global phenomenon, and that's one of our observations.
Now, would you say that the economic downturn is something that people in developing nations and the countries you mentioned and others, is something that people had already been experiencing on such a large scale, just as here in the United States, people on the bottom rung of the ladder, poor people, low-income people, jobless youth, and et cetera, have already been experiencing this economic devastation? And that this has, over the last several years, now spread much further and then just become a lot more exacerbated?
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, we've seen probably 200 million more people in the last year who've been thrust into poverty. These were already individuals who were living on the margins, very precarious lives in terms of their housing, their access to clean water, stable food supplies, the minimum standard of living. And, the numbers are probably close to 200 million more have been thrust downward. But we also see one of the reactions in the more developed countries, but not only developed either, is the marginalized people in those societies. For example, in Europe, we've seen in many of the countries increased discrimination against the Roma, who've been now largely excluded from public life in all countries. They also are not able to get access to housing or education.
And what about immigrants as well?
Immigrants, exactly. I mean, we see, for example, the those living on the margins and migrants and immigrants, they also become scapegoats. There's exploitation of migrants is another feature of this phenomenon. Xenophobia increases, and we see an increased level of violence.
And hate crimes in general as well?
And hate crimes too.
Now, what about the role of governments, Kurt, in this report? As this report shows, what are some of the negative responses that governments have been taking around the world, and what could be the kinds of things that they ought to be doing according to Amnesty instead?
Well, we see governments responding with repression often and with violence. In response to the discontent and the protest and the people going out in the streets in order to draw attention to their often desperate situation, we see governments responding with the use of often excessive force, unnecessary force. we see that governments are, in some places in Latin America, for example, using the military for law enforcement purposes increasingly. And that has resulted in an increased level of abuses and violations by against civilians, and which have been also reported to the Mexican Human Rights Commission.
Now, what about the government collusion, governments colluding with corporations? I want to quote from a statement by Irene Khan, the Secretary General of Amnesty. She said, by the end of 2008, it was clear that our two-tier world of deprivation and gluttony, the impoverishment of many to satisfy the greed of a few, was collapsing into a deep hole. Has that trend continued, and have governments colluded to continue to enrich corporations rather than helping those at the bottom, a phenomenon we've sort of seen here in the United States at perhaps a minor level compared to in poorer countries with the bank bailouts?
Yeah, that's another the feature. I mean, one of the things that we've seen is, huge attention, governmental attention by the world's strongest governments, the G20 now, focusing on how to improve the economy, how to stem the economic downturn, and huge investments in the economies to try to stop that. And what they're not doing is making similar investments in the human rights situation, which lead to the kinds of abuses that we documented in this report. So there is often a very close collaboration between governments and especially large multinational corporations, which in effect conspire to keep those struggling, and the gaps between those, and this isn't just in the developed world or the global South, but it's happening worldwide. The gap between those who have and those who don't have continues to increase, and many global corporations are an important part of that problem.
Kurt, let's talk in the last few minutes about what are some steps that can be taken. I mean, despite this doom and gloom scenario, this specter of global social unrest and deprivation, what's the silver lining here in terms of what Amnesty recommends still can be done to salvage this situation?
Yeah. Well, you know, it can be salvaged, and there are things that can be done. Although the report paints a bleak picture, you know, it's also important to understand that there have been significant achievements over the last year. You know, the announced closure of Guantanamo within a year, the executive orders that President Obama announced when he first was ushered into office, the conviction of Fujimori in Peru. There was the opening of the first trial of the International Criminal Court. There was the arrest and the transfer to The Hague of Karadzic in the former Yugoslavia. There was a moratorium at the UN on the death penalty.
So you're talking about sort of things like international justice, holding tyrants accountable, and kind of curbing the power of governments over people.
Yeah, that those are some of the steps. I mean, in Egypt, for example, there was a new law passed which banned female genital mutilation. But in all these measures, it's important that governments finally turn to acts and deeds, not just rhetoric. It's easy enough to make pledges and make promises, but it's time now to translate that into concrete action. And so this is one of the things that we are calling for in the coming, the immediate future and the coming years, is a new deal, a new global deal to pay attention to human rights, which goes beyond rhetoric, and which will translate the commitments that governments have made into concrete action.
And Kurt, as from what I understand, I mean, basically Amnesty is assuming and making the assumption that social and economic rights go hand in hand. Basically, is that accurate? I mean, that's not something that's a given here in the United States.
Yes, and this is one of the issues we highlight in the report. It is absolutely correct, as you note, that the economic, social, and cultural rights cannot be divided from or separated from civil and political rights. And so in this report, we try to highlight and pay more attention to and have devoted a lot more research to things like forced evictions, the right to food, the right to water, the right to health care, a decent standard of living. And in this respect, the United States has not played a positive role worldwide. In fact, the U.S. is the only country of the G20 now that hasn't ratified the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. So we're calling on the United States now finally to assume its fuller leadership again by getting its own house in order in the area of economic, social, and cultural rights. Similarly, China, which has ratified the Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights Covenant, but not the Civil and Political Rights Covenant, needs now to sign and ratify that covenant. So these are two leading countries of the G20. They're going to determine a lot of what happens in the years ahead, and these are very important, not only symbolic treaties to sign and ratify, but more importantly, once that's done, then to translate those, what's demanded in those covenants, to translate that into concrete action.
And of course, without action, there is peril, as this report suggests, that people across the world, it's reaching a point where a lot of people can't take anymore. Kurt, where can people get a hold of this report and maybe spread it around and share it with their colleagues and friends?
Yes, thank you. They can get the report from our website, amnestyusa.org. Or amnesty.org. It's divided into country entries, 157 of them. There are regional updates and overviews, and there's an interactive session as well, section as well of the website that includes video and photographs.
Well, Kurt, I want to thank you again very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Kurt Goering is Senior Deputy Executive Director of Amnesty International. The website he recommends, amnestyusa.org. We'll also link directly to Amnesty's latest annual report from our site, kpfk.org/uprising, later today. For Sonali, Subversive Thought for the Day, Martin Luther King Jr. once said, "Riots are the voices of the unheard." That's Martin Luther King Jr. That's Sonali, Subversive Thought for the Day. And please remember, next Tuesday is the first day of our spring fun drive, June 2nd. We're very excited to be starting that fun drive. We'll also be needing help in the phone room, so if you can come out and help, please do so. You've been listening to Uprising. To get a CD of today's program, contact the Pacifica Archives at 1-800-735-0230. Gabriel San Roman is our assistant producer. Stephanie Rivera is our intern, and Jazz Shepherd is our engineer. You can hear an audio stream of the show after 10 a.m. today at our website, kpfk.org/uprising. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening. Have a wonderful weekend. See you Monday at 8.